Hello and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson. Joining me in a bit will be Candice LePage, and we will tackle this week's movie, which will be a Christmas movie, which is appropriate. It is getting close to the Christmas time, if it isn't. I mean, technically, I suppose it is Christmas time, because people are shopping and stuff, and going out where permissible and celebrating the Christmas season, although that is, you know, more difficult in the COVID year, as we will discuss in a bit with the movie review. But, you know, there are still ways to mark the occasion. People in town, I know, organizing maps and stuff of houses decorated up for Christmas, so I mean that is one activity. So let us not lose hope and faith of the Christmas season. And perhaps we will tackle a bit of that in today's show. Anyway, End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new Christmas Adventure sequel, The Christmas Chronicles 2, which you can now stream on Netflix. For the first half of the show here, we are going to talk about the films of David Fincher. We're getting back to the old run the series bit we were doing around Halloween, you know, talking about films that are all part in the one series, except this time we're doing a filmography, I guess. We did that with Aaron Sorkin when we reviewed Trial of Chicago 7 a couple months ago. Today we're doing David Fincher. If Candice hadn't have wanted to squander our time with the Christmas Chronicles Part 2, we probably would have reviewed this week Mank, which is also on Netflix right now. It's the new David Fincher film about the writer of Citizen Kane. It is about Orson Welles, but it is David Fincher's 11th film, which means he has 10 previous films we can visit, and 10 is a nice length for a list. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to run the series on the films of David Fincher, in order from worst David Fincher film to best David Fincher film, of course keeping in mind that the worst David Fincher film is likely still better than, I don't know, the works of Ed Wood Jr. I don't know. Anyway, just that's the first name that comes to mind when you think about bad movies, but he's not deserving. Also because he's dead, so what does he care what we think? Anyway, so starting with number 10, David Fincher films. Number 10, Alien 3. It's hard to blame David Fincher for Alien 3 not working, because this film went through development hell with a capital D and an H, and by the time it got to him, and by the time he's making Alien 3, there have been like 15 drafts of the script. The studio's just on edge to finally get something going, because it had been six, seven years since Aliens. And they were just, like, really desperate to, like, we're going to finally capitalize on the popularity of that movie. We're making Alien 3. We have been through all sorts of concepts, all sorts of scripts, all sorts of directors, all sorts of ideas. And then it finally gets to David Fincher, who's making his first film. He's been a music video director till this point. It's just, like, what am I supposed to do with all this? And so it's a gigantic freaking mess from the get-go. On-set fights, pretty much the only constant you have in all this, of course, is Sigourney Weaver as Ripley, although, to the credit of Fincher, this film does end with Ripley sacrificing herself to prevent the birth of another alien queen, and it is hardcore. It is a hardcore, like, pretty much the last fight in the movie, the climactic fight with the alien, and in the metalworks of this prison planet, it's pretty well executed, and it's a shame that the movie is such a woe-begotten mess that by the time you get to this rather well executed climax and conclusion, kind of a twisty ending, because with the heroine killing herself, it deserved better, I guess, is what I'm getting at. Number 9 is The Game. It is, like, Fincher's first sort of open flirtation with, like, Hitchcockian rules of cinema. It is kind of a North by Northwest kind of story with of this guy whose brother buys him this, like, basically what we'd call a real life role-playing game now, where this company comes in and starts messing with your life, and you have to try and figure out what's real, what's not. The problem with it is it's just horrible casting all around. Like, you can't have Michael Douglas and Sean Penn in the same film. That's like, it's too much. It's too much of that energy. You also have the, you know, Deborah Kerr Unger as the femme fatale, blonde. Like, that's a typical Hitchcock thing, having the blonde-haired femme fatale. But she does not have a lot of presence in the film. Like, she was very hot coming off of Crash, David Cronenberg Crash. And so I understand why she might have been, like, the it girl of the moment. But it just, she does not work. Michael Douglas is no Cary Grant, so that does not work. It's just, it's really hard. It's really hard to get through, but there's a lot of really great stuff. This feeling of the city as this urban maze that one has to escape. That it's something Fincher does in another movie. We will mention the one he made before the game. And it's one that he kind of picks up on again and again with, like, Fight Club and Zodiac and Panic Room. But we will get there in a minute. So it sets a tone for what Fincher is capable of. The casting, which, as you will see as we sort of go on, Fincher is typically very, very good, very, very good at casting his films, but this one not so much. Number 8 is The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. I think it's too long, it's too melodramatic. It is technically an excellent film. Like, the whole idea of the man who is born old and de-ages, it's fascinating and well-executed. Like, the CGI'd Brad Pitt at the beginning, where he's like the old man kid, is really, really well done. You know, Brad Pitt has some great chemistry with Cate Blanchett in those, like, sort of middle scenes where he's like a youngish man. It's really kind of, it's not really heartwarming. I don't know how a different director would treat the material, whether they would find sort of the heart more. David Fincher really struggles to find a heart. He's not really a heart, like, a filmmaker with heart, I guess, is how I'm saying this. He's very kind of technocratic, but the film is beautiful to look at, and it's you can practically smell the fire burning when you see the cinematography, like the fireplace, not like when stuff's burning down. Also because the film begins and ends with Hurricane Katrina, so nothing's burning anyway. Number 7, I have Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. I would argue it's a perhaps unnecessary remake, because the original Norwegian adaptations of those Stieg Larsson books are probably as good as you can get. Noomi Rapace is, I think, much more dynamic than Rooney Mara is, and I think that Fincher is, he does the really hard thing, which is to not glam up Lisbeth Salander, and Rooney Mara really owns that part. I mean, to her credit, that's some solid casting that she was able to really separate herself from the person who originated that part, even though these films were just basically released like 2 years apart, the Norwegian Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and the Fincher film. Number 6, I have Gone Girl, which is Fincher's last film. I think there's too much voiceover at times. This is kind of one of my bugaboos now, is too much voiceover. But it's a really interesting study of a whodunit. It's really interesting, too, because it's basically about, like, the first half of the movie, you find Ben Affleck kind of, like, repellent, as the husband of the missing woman, and then you sort of get into her story. And what you get at the end of the movie is that these are basically two unlikable people who basically deserve each other. And it really is something to behold, how you kind of chase that emotional curve by the end of the movie. It's not what you're expecting. And I think that's another interesting dynamic to a lot of these David Fincher movies, is that you go into it expecting something, and you come out of it getting something entirely different. And we will see that again coming up. I'm having to move through this a bit more Bit more quickly now. We are about halfway through the list. One thing I'll add to Gone Girl too is the Trent Reznor Atticus Ross score is perfect. That is a perfect score in terms of like adding atmosphere and tension and character to a movie. And again, that movie is impeccably cast too. Like Rosamund Pike, Ben Affleck, like Tyler Perry, Kim Dickens, Carrie Coon. Just a really, really great cast. So number five, I have Panic Room, and this is like the other sort of explicit kind of Hitchcockian homage on the Fincher list, with this being set entirely in this one fancy New York City house that has a panic room. Jodie Foster and her daughter, first role for Kirsten Stewart, have to hide out in the panic room trying to figure out what these three burglars want. It's like basically like a five-person drama. The three burglars are Jared Leto, Forest Whitaker, and a utterly frightening Dwight Yoakam. It's got, even after watching it like almost 20 years later, there's still some real edge of your seat stuff to it. Jodie Foster is really great, and as a real bonus, like the characters are smart. This is a high tension thriller situation where nobody's really acting dumb, or at least not acting dumb in a way that's not understandable. It's really smartly written. It's really tight. And there's a lot of really great tension in it. A lot of funky Dutch angle things that Fincher's doing too. And he does a really great job of laying out the space, laying out the scene, so you're able to understand just how everything flows throughout the course of the film. Again, because it's the only one set, pretty much. Number four is Seven. That's Fincher's breakthrough film. It really set him up as a master of style. And again, this feeling of the urban landscape as this like maze, as this thing that you have to run through and try and escape, the inhumanity and hopelessness of the cityscape, which is like something that Seven would share with like other 90s movies, like the Alex Proyas movies, like The Crow or Dark City, or even like The Matrix. This feeling like you're a rat in a maze here in this city, everyone's out to get you. It's really off-putting, just the whole, and it doesn't help the fact that they don't actually name the city either, so there's this very feeling of like otherworldliness. You are transported to anywhere USA in the late 90s or the mid 90s. It's stark, and it's, you know, the one character, Morgan Freeman, who's on the brink of retirement, and can he find, like, he's this one beacon of hopefulness in all this crumbling civilization around him in this city. There's so many interesting facets to it. Unfortunately, we also now have to live with it being a Kevin Spacey vehicle. Number three is Zodiac. And again, this is another Fincher film where you go in expecting one thing and you get something else, because, you know, you expect it to be all about the pursuit of this serial killer, this real life serial killer, Zodiac, who was active in San Francisco in the late 60s, early 70s, who was really much more of a prolific letter writer than a serial killer. But it's a story about obsession, how like these three men basically get taken down with this whole idea of this killer, this guy who like names himself and sends weird ciphers to newspapers. And again, he was really more of a prolific letter writer than a serial killer, but he has this mystique, I guess is the word I'm looking for. He turned himself into a comic book villain, and because of that, he ends up sucking in these three people, a political cartoonist, a newspaper reporter, and a police detective. And it's about their obsession. And basically, how do they cope with the obsession? Do they just basically let it go? Do they turn it into a book? Do they let it consume them? Well, you have to watch The Zodiac and find out. Number two is The Social Network. And this is interesting, where I think Social Network is even more relevant now. People are much more willing to see Mark Zuckerberg as a villain now, and much more willing to look at Facebook as a beast that has destroyed us all, rather than this happy-go-lucky or whatever the heck they all thought coming up with it, this this digital nirvana that Facebook has definitely not become. Almost everyone involved in its creation is one kind of villain or another. It's kind of sad, actually. But I think the film has actually become even more prescient in the years since it came out. I think also in the 10 years, people's opinions of Mark Zuckerberg have kind of been baked in, in large part because of how he's presented in this movie, with Jesse Eisenberg's kind of conceited aloofness. And then finally, number one, we have Fight Club, which maybe we shouldn't talk about. I'm kidding. It still has punch, and that pun is intended. I would note that it's probably inspired a generation of a-holes who think that they are more enlightened than they actually are, turned a bunch of white guys into thinking they're warrior monks. Having said that, though, this is like two-thirds of a solid movie. It's a bit shaky when we get to the denouement and the Edward Norton character starts to make certain revelations. And it still works, by the way. It's a twist, and the first time you see it, it is definitely a twist. But in the rewatch, still, you are kind of suckered into this idea that there are two people involved in this relationship, shall we say, and that two distinct personalities that you're watching. And it's interesting, some of the tricks now you notice in the beginning part, the things are slightly off. Like the edits, like there's a quick cut in a scene that makes you realize something's a bit off. It eats into your perception and the way you're watching your film, and it keeps going like that until you finally get to the point of the film where you meet Tyler Durden, and it's like the film is like, it's like he's trying to bust into the film almost. Like he's just behind the screen trying to break his way through and become a part of the movie. So it's interesting to once you know the twist, to sort of rewatch and reevaluate and look at the clues. That's a lot of fun. And Fight Club is a lot of fun in that regard, although it's probably not a fun movie. But again, it's one of those like sort of more prescient things. It might be, if you haven't watched it in a while, it's worth taking another look at it now, because it might have changed some of your perceptions. Anyway, that is it for the Running the Series on Fincher. We will be back after this musical break to review something completely different, Christmas Chronicles 2. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
Houses over a million elves. Now, if you combine Amazon, FedEx, the Postal Service, and UPS with every manufacturing company in the world, and they quadrupled their output for an entire year, well, you just might be getting close to what we can accomplish here in Santa's Village in a single day.
So where's your workshop?
Why, you're walking in it.
Really?
Yes.
Well, we have over 300,000 shops here in the village.
And each and every one designed by Mrs. Claus.
Well, if she designed this place, I think it should be called Mrs. Claus's Village.
Me too.
Well, I never thought of that.
Of course you didn't.
I did discover it, and the elves built it, but I don't know. It's been called Santa's Village for over 1,000 years. It might be time for a change.
Oh, look who's a movie star.
Opata, opata.
Come on, children, let's go see. I want to show you something. You're going to love it.
And that was a clip from The Christmas Chronicles 2. It's the new film from Chris Columbus, and it stars Kurt Russell, Goldie Hawn, Darnby Camp, Kimberly Williams-Paisley, Juzzier Bruno, Julian Dennison, and Tyrese Gibson.
I am now being joined on the line by Christmas brand ambassador, Candace LaPont. Candace, how are you today?
I'm great, thank you, and I love my new title. I hope it comes with lots of influencer money.
Oh, well, that would be nice. I somehow doubt it, though. You know, we joke about your affection for all things Christmas, but I do want to start with a question about these Hallmark Christmas movies. I'm all being advertised, and I know you're a fan. When they advertise these, they say at the end, like, it's like Christmas on Main Street starring actress X and actor Y. Am I supposed to know who these people are, or are they like strictly like in the Hallmark repertoire of like Christmas movies? And so they're making like 40 of them a year, and that's why I don't know them from anything else.
Yes. So I will say, because I have, you know, as Christmas brand ambassador, I do enjoy a good Christmas movie, especially, you know, with the sort of cheesy schmaltzy. But I generally tend to veer more towards the family Christmas stories rather than the like Hallmark ones. So I've watched, you know, pretty much everything on Netflix. But this year I have decided to dive into the Hallmark world. And yes, there is a repertoire of actors, a stable of actors who do Hallmark movies. And Hallmark doesn't only make Christmas movies, they also make fall movies. So they do like an autumnal sort of theme. They do these like mysteries, the Aurora Tea Garden. And I know it sounds like I'm really knowledgeable, but it's just because I spent the last year listening to a podcast called Deck the Hallmark that reviews literally every single Hallmark Channel movie. So I have dove in this year.
Do they review them ironically or unironically?
Yes.
Oh, they do.
They do both. Yeah. So it's three guys. One of them is a huge fan of Hallmark movies. One of them is not a fan. Though I think when you spend a whole year doing nothing but watching Hallmark movies, you just become a fan. I think other movies sort of like suddenly start paling because you don't understand anymore the concept of the structure, because Hallmark movies are so exact, I will say. They're so exact in their structure. But yes, there are a group of actors, and I have come to know some of them. And those people following my Twitter feed will know that I've been watching these for about a week. And let me tell you, Andrew Walker, a very handsome man. I've heard tell of this man a number of times. I'd never seen a movie with him, but I watched one this year and realized that, yes, the world is correct. Andrew Walker is a very handsome man.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So when you hear his name on, you know, Hallmark movie starring, no, you'll know what you're in for.
He brings the handsomeness. It's interesting to hear about this perspective about, like, you can, like, basically get Stockholm Syndrome watching Hallmark movies from this one person on the podcast. I mean, I guess it's a bit like you do, the trauma movies, because they blew up the same car in trauma movies for years because they got this footage and they just kept reusing it again and again. So I guess maybe it's a bit like you just sit in the trauma movie and wait for that car to blow up again. And there you go.
Yeah. I mean, it's true. It doesn't, I will also liken it to pop music, where usually, you know, you hear a pop song, especially people in our age category hear a pop song for the first time and kind of go, this song is terrible and I can't believe these lyrics. And they just do the same thing over and over again. And then by the fourth or fifth time you've heard that pop song, you're just like, this is the like song of the summer. I want to hear it over and over again. Because you know what? We are complex human beings with complex lives, and repetition and pattern and familiarity are really comforting.
And you can read more about that in Max Martini's book, and that's how he became a multimillionaire. I could say that just David Foster too, for that matter. A lot of music producers have made a killing banking on repetition.
Yep.
Anyway, that brings us to, oddly enough, a sequel. So The Christmas Chronicles 2, the sequel to Christmas Chronicles 1, and Candace, you were so eager to review this. You told me we were going to review this in October. So
I sure did.
So I mean, you longtime fans of the show, both of them, will remember that we reviewed Christmas Chronicles 1. So I mean, aside from complacency bias, why dive into Christmas Chronicles 2?
Well, I'll also note that I seem to have spent much of this year reviewing for End Credits Radio a lot of sequels and remakes. I'm not really sure what that says about me. I guess that I'm very comforted by familiarity also. But the original Christmas Chronicles, man, just Santa Kurt Russell is everything. He's everything you want in a Santa, right down to the, you know, kind of crusty sort of old mannishness. So I was very excited to watch this one this year. And while I will say generally my review is going to be positive, I just want to put a warning out right now that maybe 2020 is not the year for Christmas Chronicles 2, because there was a pretty heavy theme of Christmas isn't about where you are, it's about who you're with, which hit a little too hard for me watching this yesterday. So just a warning there. But otherwise, I think it's all right.
It's interesting you should mention that. I'm going to dive into that in a sec, but I got out my movie book, and the last three movies that you've done on the show, The Craft Legacy, Babysitter Killer Queen, and Bill and Ted Face the Music. So we have definitely been on a sequel kick.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, putting that aside, yeah, I have some mixed feelings about this myself. Where to begin? I think the thing is, the movie opens with this like big sweeping CGI shot of the North Pole or somewhere, and then we land on one of the little elf creatures, and my immediate thought was like, oh God, this is going to be a CGI crazy fest with they've separated the human element to it, which was so great about the first one. It really felt like it could have been made 20 years ago or 30 years ago. It had a very tangible quality to it. It had a cool hip Santa at the center of it, and Kurt Russell is had a lot of great energy in it. The kids were really great, and my immediate thought was just like, oh, now it's CGI blah. It's like we're gonna separate the human emotional part out of this it starts out that way. There are moments where I feel like he does overdo it. The director does overdo it with some of the CGI stuff, like a lot of at least really wide sweeping shots of Santa's sleigh flying across the sky or across the tundra or whatever, and it just, you know, it's too big. It's too big for this. I want this to be Christmas special size. I don't want it to be Avengers Endgame size, which seems like we were kind of reaching for it at certain, maybe not as big as Avengers Endgame, but I mean, you get the idea. It's just like, I'm not tuning in for epic. I'm tuning in for Christmas jolly making. And in that regard, there is, I would say, too much epicness and, although the jolly Christmas side is still tremendous, and it still gets, you know, the cutesy laughs and the heartwarming stuff really well. It feels like it's a bit too epic for my taste, if that makes sense.
Yes, yeah, and I totally understand where you're coming from. I went through the exact same thought process as we began with, you know, some pretty heavy CGI sort of stuff going on. And then it seemed, you know, it kind of chilled a little bit, and then we got back into the like Christmas North Pole stuff. And I would say about halfway through this film, I did sort of think, I think I might need to apologize to Adam for making him watch this film. because here's the problem with a Christmas movie sequel like this. So the first one was, you know, sort of about remembering the magic of Christmas and bringing that magic into the real world. And, you know, it's something that we can all maybe, you know, even this year, we could really use that sort of thing, right? To remember that the spirit of Christmas could be any holiday. I just want to make that clear. But that spirit of, you know, a holiday is something that we can carry with us. And it isn't necessarily about all of the everything else. It's something that's inside of us. Whereas this film is all about the magic of the North Pole. And I feel like there's been a lot of other sort of movies that sort of have done this, where they start with this small, simple story about the magic of Christmas in the real world. And then if they go to a second one, it's like, oh, well, now we actually have to go bigger, and people want to know, like, we can't tell the same story again. So now let's tell, you know, open the veil on what the world is. And so we get this magic fairy tale. Now, if you're into that and you want to see that, I think that this film did a good job. And I did, you know, there were parts of it that I liked a lot more than others. And once I kind of got over my, oh, I think I might have to apologize to Adam, I was just like, whatever, I'm just going to sort of lean back and enjoy this. I know what we're in for right now. I am now watching like a Disney-ish sort of movie about the North Pole. And I'm not watching a family Christmas story, even though there was still, you know, the lessons learned as we get in every Christmas story. And so I once I just sort of got over that, I was like, okay, I know what I'm in for. That's fine. That wasn't really what I was looking for out of this film, but I'll just relax and enjoy what I am getting rather than what I wanted.
Right. I mean, there's always a danger of reviewing the movie you wanted as opposed to reviewing the movie you got. And I think that there is a case of that here. And kind of revisiting the same family. I mean, except this time the focus is on the sister's dysfunction instead of the older brother. And I did like the younger, the prospective stepbrother who comes along for the ride on this. I like that character. I like that kid. There's just it and I wonder too, if it hadn't been the same kids who were going on a new adventure, if it had been like same Santa going on a new adventure with new kids, would I be criticizing, oh, it's just like part one, where except it's this time it's another two kids that need Santa's help dealing with stuff. I wonder if I would feel if that would be my perspective too. So I'm trying to avoid falling into that trap. What I will say is that there's nothing surprising about this movie. I feel like all the story beats you sort of see coming. There's a bit of time travel in it, and I knew exactly what they were going to get out of that time travel.
But did you expect the big, like, Motown dance Christmas part
no,
of that?
At the airport? No. Perhaps there's some commentary in there about Die Hard 2. I don't know. But I did expect a musical number. Of course, that's, you know, that was the big scene in the first movie, where, you know, they go to this bar and Santa, you know, jams with all the bar patrons, and then leads into a musical number, which gives Kurt Russell a chance to rock out. That I was expecting at some point in the film. I was not necessarily expecting it at the airport. you know, the little brother too, with all his anxieties and phobias, I knew there was going to be a gimmick to that, and that would come into play. And the ending is utterly and horribly predictable in the best Christmas tradition. And yeah, I think it's an example of how maybe you can sort of love the movie for what it gives you and maybe not hate it for what it doesn't give you. And you know, what we get in this is some great, there's great moments, you know, I can focus on Kurt Russell, you know, like leaning back and saying, not bad kid. And with that wink in his eye, and instead of focusing on the, you know, playing Who Let the Dogs Out 20 years too late. So,
oh yes. Yes. So I did, regarding the elves and their Who Let the Dogs Out rave party, I did So I often don't really look anything up until after having watched the film, just so that I can go in pretty open-minded. And that, you know, in a lot of cases includes, some cast members, writers, directors, that sort of stuff. So I don't really pay attention to that. But at one point, all of the elves in the North Pole get poisoned with elf's bane and become little rockin' ravers who want to do snowball fights and do all that sort of stuff. But as they were all sort of turning into their naughty selves, I was just like, well, I'm getting a serious Gremlins 2 vibe right here. This is really reminding me of, you know, all the Gremlins in the mall going a little mad. And then, of course, at the end, it's directed by and written by Chris Columbus. I was like, oh, well, that's probably where I got that Gremlins 2 vibe from.
Mm-hmm. Except he's kind of doing it half-assed. Because, I mean, there's like some dark stuff in this. Like a reindeer gets mauled. You don't see it, but you understand a reindeer gets mauled and it's like basically on the brink of death. And then you have this like scene with the gremlins where it's basically like this former elf played by Ricky Baker, who I know it's not his real name, but I'm referring to his role in Hunt for the Wilder People, and he will always be Ricky Baker. But where he uses the elf's bane to make the elves go crazy, and it's basically like, you know, the bath salts. It's like elf bath salts. And so there's like real kind of like zombie gremlins vibe when the elves become infected. And it's just like, you kind of want to go dark, don't you? You're thinking about the good old days before PG-13, aren't you, Chris Columbus? You're thinking about The Goonies. You're thinking about Gremlins. You're thinking about Adventures in Babysitting. All these quote-unquote kids movies where you used to be able to get away with a lot more, but you are holding yourself back. This is Chris Columbus, Harry Potter-style Chris Columbus, where it's like, we don't want to go too close to the electrical fence of offensiveness. And it just feels kind of restrained. It's like, if you're gonna maul the deer, own it. If you're gonna make the gremlins. If you're gonna make the elves go gremlins, own it. And if they're going bad and it's truly a situation where like the elves are bad, we have to fix them. Who let the dogs out is not the track. It's just not the track. It's, first of all, it's 20 years too late, but it's also not the track. And I'm not a musical library, so I don't know, but I gotta think you could call somebody and go, can you give me a soundtrack that's like Who Let the Dogs Out, but, you know, better and, you know, not that.
From
like
this
more
century?
Exactly that. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Also, I think the baddest thing that the elves did at that point, I mean, you know, the snowballs was annoying, but it wasn't really bad. But they got out chainsaws, and so I thought, oh, okay, maybe something will happen here. No, they just did some synchronized dancing with their chainsaws.
Right. It's, you know, not to compare this to Evil Dead, but in Evil Dead, when you get the freaking chainsaw out, there's going to be some hacked limbs. It's Chekhov's chainsaw. But they... it's like, what if they get out chainsaws and just like cut a table in half? No, I'm not sure that sends either the message of danger or the message of craziness that you want to send. So maybe they don't get out chainsaws. It's just, you know, again, Chris Columbus is capable of this. He's capable of riding that fine line. But I think like a lot of, you know, directors and writers from the 80s, you know, who grew up maybe and can't, I mean, thinking about Steven Spielberg, who a couple of years ago made the BFG, and it's just, it's perfect Spielberg material, but he's just of an age now where he can't tap that. He can't go backwards and reclaim that ground that he used to own so well. He's just an entirely different filmmaker now. And maybe Chris Columbus is the same, that he just can't surf that fine line between gremlins eating people's faces and heartwarming family togetherness by the end, which is a shame.
Yeah. Yeah. I will say that I did really like all the performances. Of course, Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn goes without saying. I mean, you know what you're, well, you know what you're going to get from those two, and they delivered, and they were lovely. But I did really like both of the kids. So Darby Camp, who's Kate, and she was in the first film, and she was great in the first film as well. And she was, you know, I still really liked her in this film, and felt for her too. Like, you know, similarly with not going too strong with the bad elves, they didn't really go too hard on the like kind of snotty bratty kid who's mad about her mom, you know, maybe getting remarried. They sort of introduced that, but she really wasn't particularly, you know, at no point was she just sort of annoying about it. It was just like, oh, okay, well, yeah, she's upset, so that makes sense.
She's the opposite of Pete Davidson in King of Staten Island, who's admittedly a grown-ass man in that movie, but it's I was thinking about that the whole time. It's like she's the relatively benign version of the Pete Davidson character in King of Staten Island.
There you go. It's an it's quite the comparison.
Yeah.
Adult
yeah.
to child, but yep.
Yeah. So I mean it's strange the thoughts and emotions that Christmas Chronicles 2 raised, but it's been a year, so continue. Yeah.
But I also liked, you know, like you said, the sort of pseudo stepbrother or soon to be stepbrother. What was his name?
Teddy was the original brother. Jack.
Yeah.
Is the
Jack.
New brother.
That's right. Jack. Yeah. He was really good too. Right. And similarly in a role that, is clearly written to be kind of like the annoying bug of a younger guy, and he's anxiety ridden and, oh, I can't have lactose and I can't have this and I'm not allowed to do that. And so, you know, I sort of, and I don't know if it was on purpose or if it was the actual actors, whether they just didn't go with these two characters to make them as annoying as those sort of archetypes would normally be, or if you know, both Darby Camp and I think Jazeer Bruno is the name of the actor who played Jack, if they were just so you know, I just really liked them and they were very warm and it was nice to watch them. So I don't know if it was their performance that made them less annoying.
I mean, I think there's a tendency, and again, this may be having adult minds write kids, but I think there's a tendency at times. It's like if a character has an annoying aspect, especially if they're a child character, you lean heavily into that. You know, like Urkel. This is kind of a bit more low key, and I think there is sort of an appropriate reaction. Like if you go to Santa's village, you know, maybe you forget your BS and just enjoy being in Santa's village. So maybe that plays a part of it too.
could be.
But I agree with you. I like the cast. I like this mode of Tyrese Gibson in a very kind of like father knows best kind of way. I think he could really build on that as opposed to, you know, being one of the jokey guys in Fast and Furious. It's a good mode for him.
Yeah, it was great. It's like the goofy sort of dad.
Yeah. It's
the trying too hard dad, I'd say.
The trying too hard dad. Yeah, I like that. I like how that fit on him. I think that's something he can exploit in his acting future. The real appeal, I think, is the Kurt Russell, Goldie Hawn, Mr. and Mrs. Claus double act. I like, you know, how Mrs. Claus is basically a witch and nobody remarks on it. It's fun. It's just, you know, she's whipping up potions and casting spells, and that's just Mrs. Claus in a nutshell. Although we don't kind of get her origin story. We get Santa Claus's origin story, and I like how they basically try to lean into the actual Santa mythology about how Kurt Russell was from Turkey in the 4th century. But it, it's it's, I mean, that's kind of what you come here for, is the Kurt Russell set a tone in the first one as, you know, rock and roll Santa. They had Goldie Hawn at the end as Mrs. Claus. That's, I guess, perhaps intentionally teasing for a sequel. And, you know, it's coming and watching old friends. And it's not just because they're playing Santa and Mrs. Claus too, but because they're well known as this, like, the perfect Hollywood couple. They've been married for years to each other. And, you know, they're kind of the, I don't know if they're the mom and dad of Hollywood, but I mean, basically at this point, maybe we can start thinking of them that way, that, you know, they're this like fixed point of light in terms of like the personal, family friendly. I mean, also interesting to note that, you know, Kurt Russell got his start in family friendly Disney movies and things like that.
Yeah, he was a child
star. So he was a child star and he built his brand on Disney before being introduced to John Carpenter. And
and somehow these films, Santa blends that John Carpenter Kurt Russell with the Disney Kurt Russell.
Yeah, he's slightly dangerous, although I think he's slightly less dangerous in this one. There was a bit more danger to Santa in the first one, but it is kind of the ultimate amalgam. He's family friendly, but he's got an edge. All he's missing is an eye patch.
It's true. Yeah, an eye patch would really bring him over the edge. But it's true that, like, as it opened, just like you were saying, actually, it wasn't the opening, but it was his first appearance, where he's basically in, like, this massive, like, chase with his sleigh and the reindeer against a Yule Cat. And so, super over-the-top CGI. But it just makes me laugh as I'm looking at this sleigh going, good Lord, like, this sleigh is basically the car from Death Proof. Like, like, who is this Santa that this is the sleigh he's driving? And I really appreciated Mrs. Claus at one point saying to him, you know, sometimes I think you really, you know, relish these sort of more dangerous aspects.
Yeah, it's because it's implied in the first one that he's trying not to go unnoticed, but I think it's a video in the first one, they see an arm coming out of the fireplace and that makes them think about, is Santa's real, and they lay a trap for him. And if I'm remembering that correctly, but there's a part of him, the character Santa, that is like, I'm just a dude doing the job. But there's also the part of him that like is looking for trouble. Like, he will go out and do the job, but if trouble finds him, he's all in. It's kind of, yeah. I don't know if it's an interesting dynamic. It's which is another reason why I thought, you know, would they bring in like some new kids to have an adventure on? Like, every Christmas, there's this one thing that almost goes wrong because Santa goes chasing adventure instead of delivering the presents, and maybe that's a clue for maybe future Christmas Chronicles adventures, that, you know, Santa is basically this. He's basically that guy who, you know, gets the 9-to-5 job, but, you know, was in a band for years and is always having trouble reconciling the rebellious years with the working 9-to-5 job years, and always trying to find a way out. Maybe that's what I'm thinking about for the future. But
pretty sure you just explained the Incredibles.
You're right. It is the Incredibles, but with Santa. Oh, okay. But no, it's, I was surprised how long Christmas Chronicles 2 was. I'm not sure it needed to be that long. I think a tight 90 would have, but I mean, having said that, I think it delivers what it promises. I think for people who, like, of a certain age, like young people, I think it gives you enough. There's enough going on in terms of the movie with action and stuff, and it's bright and colorful. There's really nothing that doesn't lend itself to not being family viewing. I think the kids like it. I think if you are a kid at heart, you'll like it. And it could have been tighter, but
yeah,
I think all things considered, it's solid holiday watching.
Yep. I think, you know, part of the it being a little bit too long and could have been tighter is because of the, you know, warning I had up top that one of the there were maybe a few too many lessons to learn by the kids in this film. But one of them being the, you know, who you're with for the holidays is more important than where you are, which is not not something I want to hear this year. But, right. You know, there are other lessons to be learned about courage and about, you know, always being able to, you know, go back and, you know, no mistake is ever too much to not be forgiven for, all these sorts of, you know, lessons. So it fills all those, but maybe it could have chosen two fewer, maybe three fewer.
And yeah, it's, I mean, the message you're getting at is kind of unfortunate, because they probably finished filming this long before COVID was a thing. I think there's also a message in there, though, with the Ricky Baker character that, you know, you...
It's Belsnickel, by the way.
I'm sticking with Ricky Baker, because it always makes me laugh thinking about people walking through their woods yelling Ricky Baker. But this idea that he was, you know, maybe a bit too big for his britches, you know, maybe a bit too self-obsessed, that he loses the thread of the thing. And maybe there's a message in there too, because I think that, as we've seen this year, there are a lot of people out there who think they know better, and that gets them into an inordinate amount of trouble. So maybe they can learn something from the Christmas, the Christmas adventures of, Ricky Baker, AKA Belsnickel.
And I think the Christmas magic worked on you, Adam, that you think this movie is going to get through to those people. It did its magic on you.
Listen, I do not think anything, maybe I'll stop there, but if anything is going to get through to a certain subset of people who we talk about and it within an enormous amount of attention on Open Source's Guelph, I don't think it's going to be Christmas Chronicles 2. Having said that, if there is a lesson learned and they take it to heart, I'm okay with that.
Fair enough.
All right, well, let's leave that there, because we'll let people make up their own Christmas wishes. Anyway, Candace, if people want to find you on the internet, where can they do that?
You can follow me on Twitter at Sin48, CINN48, where I am slowly making my way through all 40 of Christmases, the Hallmark Christmas movies made for this year. And I might need help at the end of it all, or maybe right now.
Do you mean help watching some so you don't have to watch them all? Or do you mean help like...
Help like reminding me what other movies are like.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Fair enough. And that is it for this week's show. We hope you liked it, and if you want to listen to it again, you can find it on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. Download it on the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday at Podbean. Get it through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. And while you're on Spotify, you can get the playlist for all the music you hear on End Credits. Just go to Spotify, search for End Credits on CFRU. And there it is, and you should be able to listen to all the music we've played, and that's a playlist of about 150 some odd songs now, so happy listening. You can find us on social media on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show, or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will be back tomorrow at 5 p.m. for News and Politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to guelphpolitico.ca for my News and Politics site, or you can find my writing about horror movies at Nightmare on Film Street at nofspodcast.com. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. We'll be back next Wednesday at 3 p.m. for more End Credits, and we will see you then.